Well, this is Dennis Emery again, and I'm joined for our second session by John English. And John, what we want to talk about in this session is the National Clay Court Championships, right, and as well as your memories of some of the great players from Louisville tennis when you were growing up and as you watched them play. In 1969, the first U.S. National Junior Clay Court Championships were held at the Louisville Tennis Club. But it was kind of a long and winding road to get there. Let me just kind of start you off. In 1952, the Kentucky Junior Championships were held at the Boat Club. And they were hosted, I'm assuming, by a guy named Bobby Pyatt.
That's correct.
Okay. Who was sort of Sam before there was Sam, if I'm reading it correctly.
That would be correct.
Okay, so in 52, the Boat Club hosted, and it becomes a great tournament. Tell me some of the players who came to that tournament that you remember before you all took it over.
Well, they had a bunch of the national champions. Charlie Passerell, Chuck McKinley, and Earl Butch Buchholz, Billie Jean King. They had a series of the top American players that played there, and it became one of the three major junior events in the country for about 15 years.
And then, it says Bobby Pyatt's the driving force behind it. Tell me about him. Is this somebody that you knew, or were you too young at that point?
No, I did know him. He was like my brother. He was very passionate about the game. He had a disability. He played tennis, but he really it was only social tennis. But his involvement at the Louisville Boat Club, which was the hub of tennis at the time, they hosted the U.S. Davis Cup several times, and Bobby Pyatt was the man, along with a fellow named Doc Kelso and Garland Allen. But there was a whole team of men and women at the Boat Club that were behind it. Big tennis people, very enthusiastic. But Bobby Pyatt was the leader.
So, I mean, it seems to me like, the Boat Club, why did it go away from the Boat Club? Because it's such a great site, down there on the river, and I know the players love going there. Why did they go away from the Boat Club?
Well, it's not a good story. I mean, in today's time, it's hard to believe, but the board of directors and the people in with the say at the time they felt pressured to integrate tennis at the Boat Club. And there were those who just didn't feel like that they wanted to do that. So, Arthur Ashes, of course, he was probably the main person. And of course, what a guy, to not want to have play at your club. To me, it just seems unbelievable, but that's what it was at the time, and so they gave up on all those events because of that.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it seems to me like at that time, Sam kind of picks up the mantle.
He did.
From Bobby, and runs with it, and he moves the tournament to Seneca Park, and then just a brief history I read about the tournament. It talked about Barry Bingham, Joe Creason, Wes Gunther, right, and these were, along with yourself, that was his committee for the clay courts, or part of his committee for the clay courts. Barry Bingham, what would his influence have been?
Well, of course, he owned, the Courier Journal and then the Louisville Times and WHAS, so he was a power with
WHAS. I didn't realize that.
With a lot of resources and loved the game of tennis. He had a court at his house, and his whole family played. Sam had gone to work for the Courier about late 60s. And I was kind of a fair-haired boy, doing very well, going up in the ranks. And because of his tennis and the fact that he had gone to Yale, and they all loved that. Mm-hmm. And so Sam became very tight with the Bingham family, and they respected what he was doing for tennis and for the city of Louisville, and they wanted to back him, and they did, big time.
In a big way.
Oh, yeah.
And then Joe Creason, who, you know, the juniors around here know the name Joe Creason because the state closed championships, you know, the qualifier is named the Joe Creason Championships, and have been for, gosh, I don't know, 40, 50 years maybe.
And a long time.
Yeah. What was his influence? I know he was a great writer, but what was his influence on the tournament, you think?
Well, two things. He was very well known. He had an column in the Courier Journal for years, and extremely popular, not just in Louisville, but throughout the state. Everybody knew him and liked him and respected him. So that was a big help. And he was one of those guys who loved to play tennis. And uh-huh. He became president of the Kentucky Tennis Patrons Foundation, was a major player in that program. So, and a great guy to work with. He was extremely helpful to my brother and to the whole movement of tennis here in Louisville. It was Joe Creason. He was a good guy.
So beyond the coverage that they were able to give in the media, those guys knew everyone. They could open a lot of doors sponsorship wise. And okay, another name that seems to jump out at you from this is Wes Gunther. Yeah, what was his contribution?
Wes Gunther was just at the time was an older man, but he was just a tennis enthusiast. I don't know that he was ever a really good player. That would be before my time. But he loved the game of tennis, and anything to do with tennis, he was there to help. And he and Joe Creason and Sam were all good friends. And I can't tell you much more about it than that, other than the fact that he was a wonderful volunteer.
Yeah. Okay. So in 69 now, you're at Seneca Park for 3 years, I guess, thereabouts. Sam has this vision to build the Louisville Tennis Center. Okay, in 69 that opens, and you know, you have the National Clay Courts there the first year you're open. And I get my impression is you maybe open in May or June, and you have the National Clay Courts in July.
That's right.
Yeah. So do you remember about the first year? What was the excitement? Was there a buzz around the event?
There sure was. Actually, arguably, they had the best draw in 1969 of all of the years that we had it here, which was 37 years. They had the best draw. A fellow named Danny Birchmore from Georgia won the event. And but at that tournament was Jimmy Connors, Eddie Dibbs, Harold Solomon, Brian Godfrey, Roscoe Tanner, Raul Ramirez, who was a great Mexican player. Of course, all the Junior Davis Cup team was there, but they had six of them that ended up in the top 5 or 10 in the world, and Danny Birchmore.
Who went on to become Georgia's first All-American in tennis.
Yeah,
and a great player. And a great clay court player, the little machine.
Oh, yeah. Well, he sat on the back line and just never missed a ball.
Right.
And beat Solomon in the finals. He was not a popular player. I don't think he knew the other guys very well, and everybody was for Solomon. Jimmy Connors had gone out in the quarters because he'd injured himself. He'd hurt his foot or something. So he had a default. So he did not make it beyond the quarters because of that. But they had a great draw that year, and those guys all went on to be, you know, top players in the world.
You know, also that year you have Freddy DeJesus, who wins the 16 and unders from Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
Do you remember anything about him? What I remember about Freddy DeJesus is he had the greatest slice backhand I've ever
seen. He did. He was one of those guys that was a really, really good junior player, but didn't make it as a senior player.
Right.
He was a good player, but he didn't make it like the others did.
Interesting thing about the tournament in those early days was it wasn't just the boys' 18s. You had the boys' 16s, and you had the 18 girls. Didn't have the 16 girls for some reason, but you had the 18 girls.
That's right.
Yeah.
It was a handful. It was more than that, actually. As you said, we had the boys 18, the boys 16s, and the girls 18s. They didn't have as big a draw, but we had three events.
Right.
And really, it was unfair to the girls because all the emphasis seemed to be on the boys 18s. So we let the women go, I think in 71, 1971. That was the last year of the women's. And then we let the 16s go in 74. But you have to remember, we not only had the boys 18, the boys 16s, and the girls 18s, but we had the tennis classic.
Right, the week after.
Back-to-back tournaments. And then in 1971, my brother and I co-hosted or directed the Virginia Slims tournament. They were looking for another event in September, and we agreed to do it at the Tennis Center. Billie Jean King came and won it, but beat Rosemary Casals in the finals. But we had worn our volunteers out,
right?
As you can imagine, having the junior tournament and then the tennis classic and now a women's tournament all within 8 weeks. The kids are all back in school. It was a burnout. So we only had it 1 year, and that's when we decided we really need to put an emphasis on what we do the best. And so that's when we cut it back to just the boys and then eventually just the boys' 18s.
Right. And then put your focus on the pro event and the boys' 18s.
That's right.
You know, one of the things that I remember was the national team came to this tournament every single year.
They did.
And you probably don't remember this, but I was the associate coach on the national team in 1982. So Chuck Willenborg won it, and Ricky Leach won the doubles with Tim Paulsen. So that was my first year. I had coached the 82 season at Austin Peay and was coming to Kentucky, but hadn't started yet. I was coming in September. But I remember how much those guys were looking forward to the national clays. It was part of that circuit where you had the national clay courts, and then you had another tournament in between there, and then you had Kalamazoo.
That's right.
You know, which David Markin hosted up there. He was the Sam English of Kalamazoo.
He was.
Yeah. And, yeah, so any interesting stories from having the national team there? You know, I remember is having to drive, and I had to drive it, that long limousine that David Markin, you know, that seated 12, and I had to drive that without any, you know, experience or training or anything like that. But any stories from the national team or the coaches?
Only that they stuck together. They practiced together. They were a team, and the other guys were outsiders, sort of,
and bitter about it.
Yeah, they weren't part of the team. They all wanted to be part of the team,
right?
Because they had to edge up on everybody because of the special teaching and all the advantages that were given them. But yes, we were lucky every year we had the Davis Cup team, the Junior Davis Cup team here. In 1972, Vitas Gerulaitis came to town. And I think I've told you the story that he called my brother and said, "Sam, I'm coming to Louisville." Sam was pleased to hear that because he was the top junior player in the country. And he said, "I'm going to win your tournament easily, but I do want to come, and I'm looking forward to seeing you." Sam said, "That's fine. Come on." And he did. He came, and he won it easily. And then actually he turned pro the next year and came back to our tennis classic and got to the semifinals. But he was a real fireball, to say the least. Very talented player. And I don't know that he ever really reached his, potential.
Even though he was top four in the world.
Yeah.
And a U.S. Open finalist.
He's a great player. Yeah. And I still don't think he reached his potential because of his lifestyle. But an interesting guy, to say the least.
And someone who loved the ladies.
Oh, yeah.
And the ladies, to quote you, and the ladies loved him. Well, the tournament moves around a little bit. You're at the tennis center, and then at some point you decide to move it to Blairwood. What precipitated that move?
Well, I co-chaired the tournament with my brother from 1970 to 1983, and kind of got out of tennis for a little bit, and that was Sam's decision. I think he had a good working relationship with Chris Burkle, who owned Blairwood. The event needed more courts.
Uh-huh.
And Chris...
Because the draw kept getting bigger, though you took less age groups, the draw kept getting bigger.
Yeah. It was a big event, big by size-wise, and they just needed more courts. Blairwood had a lot of courts at that time. And Chris Burkle was a good host, and he made the decision to move it to Blairwood. And there were a lot more facilities out there, motels, etc. Just a better location for that time.
Bittersweet though to leave the tennis center.
Very,
I think.
Yeah.
After ever the blood, sweat, and tears that went in to getting it built and everything. But you had, I think, at the tennis center, maybe 12 courts. Is that right?
10.
10 courts, which isn't going to get it done for 128 or a 256 draw. Okay, after Blairwood, you also leave Blairwood at one point. In the last 11 years of the tournament, you play at the Louisville Tennis Club over on Hare Lane, outdoors on the clay.
That was a decision that was made by Sam and Chris Burkle, because he owned both clubs.
He owned both places.
And they had the use of both clubs, so they had a lot of courts available. But that was a decision that they made to move it over there, and I'm not really, don't recall exactly what the reason was, but other than the fact that it was just, they felt a better location.
Right. Well, I'm going to ask you about any specific memories you have of the tournament. Let's run through some of the people who played this,
sure,
who won it, okay? And just a reaction. In 69, we talked about Chris Kemmer won the girls.
That's right.
Who, as I remember, every boy in the tournament had a crush on,
Understandably so.
Okay, and then in 1970, Harold Solomon wins the event, and he comes back to win the pro event twice. John Whittlinger wins the boys' 16s in 1970. Any memories of those guys as junior players?
Absolutely. They were, Whittler was a very popular young player. He won the 16, and I think he won
The next year he won the 18th.
Won the 18th the next year and came here as a pro. He was a good player, but not a great player.
Right.
And
not Vitas Gerulaitis.
No. He did not fare well here as a pro, but a good guy. We were, of course, glad to have him back. The biggest memory I have, or certainly one of the biggest, was John McEnroe. He came in 1976, And he had a name before he got here. I mean, he was a well-known player as a junior, and the papers here really played him up. We had huge crowds for the junior tournament. Biggest crowds probably we ever had was when McEnroe was here. And
now, when you say he had a name for himself, did he have a name as being a hothead or the name of being a great player?
Both. Both.
Okay.
It was clear that he was going to be a great player. And he also was difficult. But he played Van Wininski in the finals. And for some reason, the umpire that we had for that day could not make it at the last minute. So, So Sam and I talked about it, and I said, well, I'll do it. I had umpired quite a bit, and I said, I'll take it. And we had a beautiful day, big crowd. And Van Wininski was a good guy, but he also had a temper. And they started playing, and the language got out of hand real fast. So I called him. In those days, there weren't the rules that they have now. You know, the umpire didn't have a lot of authority. But I took it upon myself to have the authority. I didn't have it, but I took it. And I called him to the net, and I said, boys, we've got a lot of kids watching your match, and we've got a lot of older people watching your match. And your language is, we can't have that. And so I'm going to give you a warning. And if it continues, we're going to put you on the next plane. This big crowd will be very disappointed, but we can't have that. And they looked at me like, you know, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm serious now. No bad language. Well, they complied. They were mumbling, but you couldn't hear what they were saying. And John McEnroe went on and won the match easily. But I often thought, what would happen if, you know, I couldn't back it up.
Yeah.
But I could threaten them, and I did, and it worked.
When you say you had, how big a crowd do you think there was for that?
Oh,
match?
Probably filled up one side, maybe 800 to 1,000.
Yeah.
Biggest crowd we ever had. And it really was because of McEnroe and the paper playing him up.
Well, I think this is correct. The next year, McEnroe went to Wimbledon.
He did.
And went to the semis of the men's singles.
Yeah.
Qualified and went to the semifinals, lost to Connors, you know, in the semis at Wimbledon in the men's. Played the junior that same year and then went to Stanford, you know, for his freshman year.
He was the real deal.
Did any off-court antics with John McEnroe?
Not that I can recall. There was a lot of, he was given a lot of attention by the press because I think everybody really understood that this was going to be the next great player. And of course, it turned out that he was.
I'm assuming he was on the national team, but.
He was.
Yeah. I was going to say maybe you don't make that assumption because sometimes those guys would pass on on doing it.
My recollection was that he was.
Yeah. The national team members, they stayed in housing though, right?
They did.
Yeah. You don't have any idea who John McEnroe
stayed
with?
No, I don't. I don't remember that.
You know, or Gerolaitis.
No. No, I don't.
Yeah. Because that would have been an interesting contact to have made. John McEnroe at that point.
You know, the next year, I'll interrupt you a little bit, Mel Purcell and a fellow named Chip Hooper won the doubles.
Correct.
And of course, as we know, Mel is the best tennis player ever, male tennis player ever to come out of Kentucky, and was kind of quite a character in his own right, and still is. But a wonderful tennis player. And, it was the one Kentuckian that really did well. Although Gary Pluck did well as well, but not like Mel.
Right.
Mel was a terrific player.
Yeah, Mel ends up being top 20 in the world.
Yeah.
But at that point, he's kind of the Huck Finn lookalike, and, you know, from Murray, Kentucky.
Yeah.
And he and the Hooper win it, and then Mel goes on to win the NCAA doubles. Okay, now, there's has to be incidents with Mel during the tournament. You may not remember them, but there was never a tournament that Mel went to that there was not an incident in some way. But anything that stands out to you about Mel, other than, you know, he didn't have a backhand, but he had a great forehand. He was fast.
He was very fast and hit the forehand like a rocket.
Right.
His father taught him, Benny Purcell, and did a good job. I mean, I don't remember any instances with Mel. I mean, he was on his home turf, so to speak. I think I didn't think he wanted to be a problem, and he wasn't.
I'm sure the newspapers really covered him in 77.
They did.
Yeah, I was going to say, you going down another guy who came, Luke Jensen, you know, who ends up dual hand Luke. Yeah. He ends up winning it in 84. Any thoughts about him?
No.
And his mother?
I don't have a whole lot of recollection about him other than the fact that he was a character.
Yeah.
And a good player, and didn't really make it that big as a pro.
Not in singles, but he ended up winning the French Open in doubles.
In doubles,
he could play. With his brother.
He could play.
Yeah. You know, another interesting year would have been 96 for you all. It seemed like a little bit it went in spurts where you had really great players. You know, of course, it would be cyclical with American tennis, you know, the strength of your draw. But in 96, Bob Bryan wins the singles.
That's right.
You know, and then wins the doubles with his brother Mike. They go on to become the greatest doubles team of all time. The memory I have of those guys is they were apparently weighed less than 100 pounds when they won the tournament. You know, they were so small. Do you remember anything about those guys being here?
Only that they were the talk of the tournament. The fact that they were brothers and twins.
Twins.
And could really, really play. And they played it at Blairwood that year, those years. And they dominated. I didn't know how good they were going to be in singles, but boy, did they prove it in doubles. And probably the best doubles team of all time.
Yeah.
Certainly their record would say that. Two outstanding young men, too. You know, they were the type of kid that you wanted at your tournament. Nice looking, attractive. And
pure Southern California.
Yeah, easy to be around. Yeah, good guys.
The next year, James Blake wins your event.
He did.
He ends up being top four in the world. You know, semis of the U.S. Open. My one memory of James Blake at that tournament, and hopefully you'll have another one, was Susan Terry, who ran the desk there, was one of your, you know, all-time great volunteers.
That's right.
Susan Terry told me James Blake was sitting beside her, and she said James Blake was, you know, 5'4" and, you know, maybe 120 pounds.
He was not big.
Yeah. She said this little African-American, fast as lightning guy with this really good forehand. And she said, what are you planning to do? You know, and he said, I'm going to be, you know, number one in the world. And she said, I looked at him and I thought, there's just no chance you're going to be a professional player. You know, you're just too small. But and I'm sorry, because it's funny the way it works out. And later on, like I say, he's one of the great players in American history. Yeah.
Well, he was clearly one of the best black players ever to play here.
Right.
And, of course, he went on, got a great education. And
at Harvard.
Yeah. And made his – he was a player and made a big hit here when he won.
Yeah. Well, good. We get down to the later years of the tournament now, and we'll come back, you know, to any other memories you might have. But, you know, the Kentucky Wildcats and their coach recruited a guy named Jesse Witten. And Jesse won your tournament in 2000. You have any memories of him winning it? Or I think, I don't know kind of how that fell, the chronology of when he came to Kentucky. Well, he came in the fall of 2001. So he won it in 2000, came back in 2001, and lost in the semis, because I came down and saw that match. But any thoughts about Jesse, who's you know, one of the greatest, best players we ever had at UK?
Well, in 2001, he had a great partner.
Yeah.
I don't know whether you know him or not, but his name was Emery.
Right.
Matt Emery, of course, your son. Well, they won it in 2001, which had to be a huge thrill for you and for him and for Jesse. Because they were playing really good doubles at that time.
Yeah.
Really good. And, of course, it was great to have a Kentuckian win. Mel Purcell had won. But really, I think Matt was the only other Kentuckian to actually win either the singles or the doubles. So you'd have to say he's one of the best doubles players ever to come out of our state.
And well, you know, just speaking from a personal standpoint, very proud moment for us.
Oh, yeah.
And the reason was, all these people who had kind of supported us and Matthew were able to come out and watch that event. And not to get off on this, but, you know, Matthew had won, they had beaten Thomas Burdich and Pechner first round at Wimbledon that year. They were the number one seeds. You know, Burdich ends up being top five in the world, but they had beaten them. And the match ends, and we're looking around, and there's nobody there. there's literally no one to share it with. You know, you're in London, and you have this great win. You've beaten the number one seeds at Wimbledon. But, you know, you could have been at a public park anywhere, you know, because, for all the people you knew. And what made that event so special for all of us was, you know, Herb Case and all the people that could come out and watch him play, where they would never get a chance really to watch him play. And I know when I've talked to him, his two best memories in tennis are winning the national clay courts, the doubles, and winning the state high school.
Well, we were always pleased when a Kentuckian did well, and we had some that did well, and of course your son was one of them.
But it had to mean a lot to you to see, you know, the impact it had on the players here locally. And what I'm going to do is before we back up, you know, some of the guys, there was...
I do have one other story I want to tell
you. Sure, great.
In 1998, and you're going to have to help me with the pronunciation of his last name, Bob...
Kowalczyk.
Bob Kowalczyk, unusual name, but he was from Florida and a really good clay court player.
Yes, he was.
And he won the tournament in 1998. And was at 17. And he came back and he had another year, but he didn't qualify because he had some injuries, and you had to go through all these qualifying tournaments to become eligible.
Particularly in Florida.
Yeah.
I forgot that.
So he wasn't sponsored by his state or his section. So he called Sam, my brother, and said, you know, I'm not eligible. Is there anything you can do about it? And he said, absolutely.
Yeah.
So, what happened was Sam called the USTA office and said, you know, my defending champion is not eligible, but I want him in the tournament, period, end of subject, you know. And they let him in, and he wins it.
And he won it again.
he won it, which was a great story. And he wrote a sort of a memo to Sam, which I've kept calling him his hero. And I see him occasionally in Florida when I'm down there. He still plays in the Vero Beach area. He's a professional there in Vero Beach. But every time he sees me, he talk about the days that he was here and what my brother did for him.
Well, I loved going to that event. You know, when I was growing up, I just started playing. And one of my memories, and I don't know if you'll remember this, but... Charlie Ellis and Gary Plock played together in doubles, and that would have been in, gosh, I guess 72, you know, I think 72, mm-hmm. maybe 71. those two guys played together, which, you know, they were, I won't say they were enemies, but they were rivals. And, you know, I remember Charlie Ellis telling me, I'm going to play doubles with Gary in the clay courts. And I want to say, well, how is this possible? You know, I can't believe you guys are. And, but they get to the semis and they play Victor Amaya and Dupre, I think, in the semis. And Gary had stationed, Gary and Charlie had stationed people on both ends of the courts there to steal the signals from, you know, when they were going to poach. And Victor Amaya caught on. And Victor's 6'6".
Yeah, I know.
And he's ready to kill Mr. Plock, you know, and Mr. Ellis, you know, who were stationed at the ends of the court. He's ready to go. Any other funny stories like that that would relate to
things
like that?
Well, the rest of that story is that Gary's father was very intense.
That's yes.
Putting it mildly. And loved his son and wanted his son to win, but was a little overbearing.
Right.
And my brother had to ask him to leave the facility, which I think was the only time that I can remember that we ever asked anybody to leave the facility.
Oh, my goodness.
That he just said, you know, we can't have this, and asked him to leave. But that's my memory of that. I do remember it, yes.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, because, you know, it's one of the better performances by the locals.
Yes, it was.
You know, was those guys getting to the semis. And I remember the newspaper really covering, you know, because I was new to tennis at that time, and it was fun to follow that. You know, huge impact on junior tennis, you know, the event. I can't go back, you know, far enough to but during my time, I saw what it meant to, you know, have Gary Plock, Kevin Walsh, JT Sims, all those guys, you know, really loved focusing on being able to go to the clay courts. So you had sort of that generation of players that it impacted, and impacted in a big way. You know, yeah. Gary goes on to Texas and beats John McEnroe in the semis of the NCAA doubles. Okay, and then you have this next generation of players, which is Mel Purcell, Charles Beckman, and those guys that came out of this area playing in the clay courts. And then you have that next generation of players, which was Matthew Emery, Colin Purcell, who got to the semis, Chris Gagner, who got to the finals the 1 year, you know, from Louisville here in 2000. It would have been 2001. He got to the finals, beat Witten in the semis. Can you think of other players that may be impacted other than those guys? I mean, I know I'm taking the top guys off of your yeah. list, so it's a little unfair.
Well, Mark Buechler and Paul Lang.
Of course, yeah.
They were real good players. They weren't great players, but they were very, very good. But no, I think you kind of covered the top players. Kevin Walsh. Kevin ended up being a very, very good player.
Yes.
But it was an incentive for the local players. They wanted to play in that National Junior Tournament. And we wanted them to play. We were going to do everything we could to get them in.
Right.
But we had our rules, but we wanted them in the tournament. And, of course, a bunch of them got in.
Right. Well, very inspiring for, I'm sure, all the people who are out there, you know, taking lessons, those juniors to watch that low. I know it was for me. So, you know, before we go into the end of the tournament, any other kind of favorite memories you have of the tournament? Yeah.
Well, there are a lot of memories, obviously. We housed the boys at Bellarmine College.
Right.
And with that much chaperoning. That was a test.
Yeah.
they somehow they didn't know what the rules were, and we had to put a foot down several times there, and we would have meetings at the tennis that we'd bring all the players in and say, you know, we, you know, you all are welcome here, but you got to behave. And of course, most of them did. It was just a few bad apples, but I can remember that was always kind of a problem. And it was better when they all stayed at private homes.
Yeah.
Because they had the chaperone of the people that owned the home. And that was one memory. Basically, it was just every year we had a new crop coming in. And it was, and you know, who was going to be the next great player. And because they all came through here. Sampras came through here. The Gullickson twins. They were just... almost every player that turned out to be, I think without exception, played in the National Junior Tournament when we had it. Sam actually ran it 37 years, and he passed away in 2002. And, you know, he said to me then, he said, well, you know, we're going to lose this tournament when I leave this earth. And, of course, we did the next year. They kept it for 1 year.
Right.
He died in the summer of 02, and we played the tournament in 03, and they moved it to Washington.
Now, do you think they moved it because it just couldn't really go without Sam, or were there other factors?
That was the big factor. I was out of it by then, and had been out of it for some time. I mean, he was the man.
Yeah.
And the whole tennis world knew it. And Donald Dell, who was his friend, wanted the tournament. And there really wasn't... I mean, I don't mean to slight the people who worked on it, because they were great volunteers. I mean, we had some really good volunteers through the years. There wasn't that one person that could take it and run it on a year-round basis. And it was something that didn't... just happened. You worked on it pretty much off and on all year.
Right. Those events are things that you have to spend an hour or two a day on.
You do.
Until the month before, and then you really have to hit it, you know, that month before. You really...
No question.
You're locked in for 6-7 hours a day. And then the tournament, when it's on, it's 24/7, you know. But
busy time.
Yeah, they ended up moving the tournament to D.C. I always kind of felt like Washington bought it. You know, they offered wild cards. They offered, all the matches would be chair officiated, you know, at great expense, great expense. And I always felt like that was just a non-sustainable model, which, as it ended up, was true. It ended up moving to Florida. You know, I think they got into it and realized... we've bit off more than we can chew here.
I think that's what happened.
Yeah. You know, you've been around a long time. Okay, so you've seen a lot of people, you know, in this Louisville area. So I'd like for you to just kind of talk about some of these guys, how they played, what you remember about them. The first one's Don Kaiser.
Don Kaiser, yeah. Don... grew up here and lived here and played at Male High School and went on and played at Miami. And I, in my mind, was probably the best male tennis player ever to come out of Louisville. Real nice looking guy, a ladies' man to say the least, but in a nice way. And he got to the finals of the Southern Tennis Tournament, Southern Men's Open Tennis Tournament twice, got beat by Ham Richardson, which was, you know,
that works.
Yeah,
it's pretty good.
He was by far the best player in the South. But Don was the tennis pro at the Louisville Country Club for about 10 or 12 years, a very popular pro. Everybody was very fond of him. But he moved to Florida, got married, moved to Florida, and continued to teach until he was 80. He died this year. Tennis was his life. He really...
And he was ranked like 21 in the country, right?
I think he got
US.
Down to...
And this is before there were world rankings, right? Outside the top 10. You know, they would rank the top 10 players in the world. But he was 21 in the country, which may have been the highest.
I think, to my knowledge, it was the highest. It may have been other guys who would be as good, but they didn't reach the ranking that he did.
Mm-hmm.
A fun person to be around, for sure.
Max Brown.
Max Brown. He was my age. He was the best junior player by far when we were growing up. He was on the National Junior Davis Cup team.
Right. One of the very few Louisvillians,
yeah,
or Kentuckians.
Not a whole lot.
Yeah, to be honest.
But he was. He was very mature physically for his age. And he dominated all through those junior years and went on to Notre Dame and was a very good player and became a doctor. And I think he got out of the game. Mm-hmm. I lived down in Bardstown, and I never really saw him much after that.
Is he still alive, do you know?
I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. Well, the next one is kind of a legendary guy when I was growing up, Jackie Cooper.
Jackie was, of course, about 7 years younger than me, but a whale of a player. I mean, he was one of six Coopers, the six Cooper boys, and he was the best player of the six. National junior champion with a couple different times in doubles. And
now he won Kalamazoo with Mickey, right?
I think he did. Uh-huh. Yeah, they were
the 15 and unders. The age groups were different back then, but yeah.
Mickey was a year younger.
Uh-huh.
Jackie was a wonderful tennis player. In a way, everybody loved Jackie, but he was a little bit of a flake.
Uh-huh.
But he was never knew whether he was going to show up for the match because he'd forgotten it. But a really, really good player and a good friend of ours. He won my brother had the Louisville Country Club Invitational for about 25 years. And those first 10 or 12 years, Jackie and Mickey Shad dominated it. I think Jackie won it seven times and Mickey about four or five times. It was a real rivalry. They were friends, played doubles together, and that was in the day before the tennis classic, when that was the best tennis that you could see locally.
Right.
So the crowds at that event were big, and everybody looked forward to it. It was a real rivalry between Mickey and Jackie. And I'd have to say Jackie maybe had the upper hand in the long term.
My impression was Jackie was more talented. Mickey was more of a grinder. Jackie wasn't all there that day, you know, Mickey could beat him, especially on the clay.
And he had a few years there where he did beat him. Mm-hmm. And then Jackie came back and ended up beating him. Jackie ended up in California and, of course, passed away a few years ago. Made himself a big name out there.
Right.
Good guy.
One of the original people with Charlie Passerell on the Indian Wells.
That's right.
Tournament, you know, in the very, very beginning, you know, Jackie was involved and then decided, I think, you know, kind of not to be. And, well, Mickey Shad.
Mickey was a whale of a player. He won everything that he could. National junior tournaments. He was an outstanding junior player. His size kind of got to him. He was not very big, and so he never really made it as a professional. But had a long career of teaching, and is out of the game now. But clearly, one of the best players ever to come out of Kentucky. Mm-hmm. Clearly.
Debbie Simmons Wells. Because she just jumps out at you because she won all the time.
She did. She never did lose, I don't think. She played at the Bow Club, and her family was involved in the game. She was a Bow Club brat, so to speak, but in a nice way. And she just won everything. She dominated when she, as a junior here, moved out of town. And we haven't seen her for years, but she was a dominant player when she played. Cute girl.
Yeah. Gary Plock.
Gary Plock. Gary and his brothers all played. Quite a family. Gary, of course, was an outstanding player and ended up being an All-American at Texas. clearly, and it's certainly in doubles, one of the best players ever to come out of Kentucky, has been involved in tennis all of his life, still is involved. He's a real walking encyclopedia about the game of tennis. He knows everybody, and knows a lot about the game, is still very, very interested in the game. Fun to be around.
Maybe the best left-handed serve.
Oh, yeah.
Ever in Louisville.
I hated playing against him.
Yeah.
Because he had that big slice, and he was tough.
You know, you're speaking about the Plock family, you know, very influential, okay? But the other two families are the Cooper family and the English family, you know? Good friends, rivals. How would you describe your all's relationship?
Oh, yes, rivals, but you'd say more good friends. They were younger. Billy, the oldest of the Coopers, was close to my age, and I actually played some doubles with Billy, and he was a really good doubles player, and then became a good golfer and a good friend of mine. But all the Coopers could play. Timmy, the youngest, would maybe tell you that he was the best player, and have some argument, but he wasn't. Jackie was the best player. Timmy won the state championship, state high school championship, I think four times.
Four times. One of only three to do that.
Yeah, Chucky.
Still teaching.
Still teaching. Wonderful guy who loved the game of tennis. And all the Coopers, what a family. I mean, incredible.
Yeah.
I don't know how the mother, their home was the clubhouse of Tyler Park. But they would be one-of-a-kind family.
Yeah.
In Louisville.
Elam Huddleston.
Elam was Sam's real good friend and competitor. Sam had a big winning margin over him. I think they went back and reviewed it, and I mean, it was something like 18-3 in their one-loss rivalry. But Elam was a real good player. He didn't keep himself in as good a shape as he probably should have, or he'd been a better player.
Sorry.
Should I deposit?
Yeah, sorry.
I'm not too sure. Still. I think
you
might have to unlock it.
Yeah.
You want to have juice?
Oh, it's still going.
Oh, okay. Perfect.
Okay.
Elam was one of our umpires. Actually, probably our premier umpire for the 10 or 11 years at the tennis class. When the big matches came along, Elam was the one we called on. He was really good. And he was respected by the players. They knew that he knew what he was doing. And was a great volunteer for the Tennis Classic and the National Junior Clay Courts. He was in high school with me. He was a good high school basketball player. He's a good athlete. And one of the better players that Louisville ever had.
Yeah.
Played for Indiana.
Yeah, when you look at those guys, there was a real period of time there, you know, with Sam and Elam and Rod McNerney and Billy Evans, and there was a real period of time that those guys did great. Dick Swigert?
Dr. Dick Swigert. Came here as out of college and out of med school, and taught at the University of Louisville forever. A major player in Kentucky tennis. He was always involved in everything that went on. President of the State Association, president of the Tennis Patrons Foundation, longtime tennis player, and passed away a few years ago. But a major player in tennis in Kentucky for a long, long time. Good friend of Sam's and mine.
You know, let's finish up here with, let's talk about you for a second. So you, after you play at center and you play the country club tournaments around here and the state opens and the state closed, and you kind of get to where you, and you obviously do the administrative stuff as we talked about with the clay courts and the Louisville International Tennis Classic. But, you know, you also ran, you were involved with running some of the premier facilities here and investing in them, running them. Tell me about getting involved over the, it, would it be called the Plantation? It'd be Louisville Indoor Racquet Club, but it was at Plantation. You were one of the investors in that originally?
Well, I was. I was fortunate to have an older brother who was an entrepreneur. And consequently, I was involved with most everything he ever did. I mean, whether it be the indoor tennis clubs or the tournaments or whatever he was involved in, I seemed to be involved with him. But in 1967, he had the idea of putting in a two-court air structure bubble over Plantation's outdoor tennis courts. We had no indoor tennis in Louisville in 1967. And we invested, we had about seven investors. Elam Huddleston was one of them. Put up about $30,000-$35,000 and rented the two courts from Plantation. That started indoor tennis in Louisville. People weren't used to paying to play indoors.
Right.
It was amazing to us that here we had an indoor facility, and sales were not real good initially, but it turned out real well. I mean, a couple of years later, we sold the two-court bubble and put a three-court bubble in, and then built a four-court permanent structure, so we had seven courts, and doing very well. We had no competition. And in 1972, the group with Don Varga, Mike Kemper, and Jackie Cooper, and Billy Evans, and so forth, a bunch of them, formed Louisville Tennis Club over on Harrell Lane. So we sold that facility in 1972, and relatively speaking, made a nice profit. It was small dollars, but it was a good investment. And then in 1976, we had the idea of converting an old building, an old house, Melwood and Zorn, into a eight-court indoor tennis facility. And the house would be the clubhouse. And then it actually would end up housing it was headquarters for the National Junior Clay Courts and the pro tournament and so forth. But we were all involved in the USTA. I mean, we would always go to the national meetings, wherever they would be, and we thought we'd put clay courts in, if it worked. And we got a lot of information from various places around the country that it could work, and it would work. Wrong, it didn't work.
It did not work.
It did not work. And we had beautiful, eight beautiful courts. Everybody was excited about playing on clay courts indoors, and it wasn't long before we realized that it rained indoors, literally. The building would sweat and make holes in the courts, and it was not a good idea. So we, actually, my brother got out of the business, and I had two or three partners, but I was a managing partner for about four or five years. And what we did was we converted four of the courts to hard courts, and that worked out fine. And I had the idea of converting the other four courts to indoor soccer, which was becoming popular. Soccer was just begun, and I thought this might be something we could do. So I flew out to St. Louis, spent a day out there and visited three facilities, came back with just a mammoth amount of information of how to do it, what to do and what not to do. And we built the first indoor soccer club in 1981. And that was successful to a point. And but I was doing this out of my hip pocket. I mean, I had a business that, a real business that I was all involved in, and trying to raise three kids and involved in all sorts of other activities in town. And, you know, enough was enough. I mean, so we ended up selling it to Chris Merkel, and he took it to another level. But it was fun, but not very profitable. That was my indoor tennis history.
Is there anything else you wanted to talk about on today, you know, about Kentucky tennis or your involvement, anything that I didn't hit?
It's hard to talk about yourself. It's been fun to stay involved in the game. I'm on the Raise a Racket committee that raises money for the USCA Kentucky, which is, we're in the midst of doing that. And of course, I do chair the Hall of Fame committee, which I've done for about 10 or 12 years. You're one of our esteemed board members. And just whenever I can help, I do. I've been active in getting some pros to town. Just whatever I can do to help is stay in the game, so to speak.
Well, I can't imagine, you know, a family that's given more to tennis in Kentucky than your family. And they continue, you know, with your son and his philanthropic efforts in tennis.
Yeah, I have three boys, but David, my youngest son, is the most involved. He loves the game of tennis and is very involved. We'd like to even be more involved to get through this pandemic.
Yeah, and it just continues to pass down through David, I think.
Yeah.
John, thank you for your time today.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you coming to see me, and it's been a pleasure.
All righty.